For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
And that's, you know, for me, I always talk about it is almost easier at times to close because you know it's on the hitter to be the hero. So as long as you don't make an egregious mistake, you're going to be okay.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's from Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to former Stanford standout and big league closer, Drew Storen. Drew talks life in the back of a bullpen in some big games, like the 2008 College World Series and big league playoffs, but also talks about the emotional and physical struggle of battling for the closer job year after year in the big leagues. We talk about making it to the big leagues less than a year after being drafted. We remember some guys like Stanford running back Toby Gerhart and Steven Strasburg, and we talk about his role in possibly the coolest post-career move we've ever had on the show as the co-founder of Field of Dreams Whiskey. We start the episode with that and then finish with that too. It's a cool story, cool brand. Highly recommend you check it out. Really glad that Drew stopped by. Really enlightening tale of life in the back of the bullpen. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm right now drop once a month. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. Pitchers and catchers have reported it is a great time to be subscribed to Baseball America. Tune in for all the prospect spring training coverage, see who's going to be making the team. All that good stuff is available on BaseballAmerica.com. And with that, let's talk to Drew Storen. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom the Farm, he's a first-round pick of the Nationals out of Stanford in the 09 draft, former big league closer Drew Storen. Drew, thank you so much for joining the show.
Kyle, thanks for having me, man.
Of course. And before we get into it, I want to talk about what you're doing now. I told you before we started recording, you have one of the coolest post-career ventures of anyone we've had on the show. Tell me about Field of Dreams.
Yeah, I appreciate it. As I told you before, I needed to have an answer to do something, something to chase when I was done. So I always collected a bunch of bourbon during my career, and kind of fell in love with like kind of the lore. And, you know, it wasn't really about the money as much as like it was having a bottle that somebody else didn't, you know. That was kind of like the competition. And was on a random road trip with my best friend from home in 2018. And we were talking like, hey, all these bourbon stories we're hunting, like if we were to do our own, what would it be? And that's when we landed on using the corn from the Field of Dreams movie site and making bourbon out of it. So it was an idea that just never went away. And we spitballed it, you know, year after year, just kind of like, man, nobody ever said why it wouldn't work. And so when I quit pretty much at the end of 20, I was like, let's see if we can do this, man. Like, and again, it seemed really simple from 10,000 feet high, but, it's been a great learning experience. And also like, it's a great excuse for me to hang out with my old buddy. So like Tyler Clippard and Jerry Blevins are the other two owners in this. So we just hang out, man. It's just like hanging out in the bullpen.
Rec spec legend, Tyler Clippard.
That's right. That's right.
We're gonna circle all the way back to Field of Dreams. We kind of wrap this, but I want to go back to your upbringing, kind of getting into baseball. What was in the water in Brownsburg Little League in Indiana back in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, just wild, man. I think there was you obviously have kids that were passionate about the game, but you also had good parents that fostered that, and it just, you know, when those teams first went to the Little League World Series, that was the team that Lance Lynn was on. It just created kind of this identity of small town Brownsburg. And we just kind of had a string of three really good years of winning the state. And then we all got to high school, and Lance and I, his senior year, we were 35-0 as a team. 'Cause he would pitch one game and I'd just play first and we'd switch. So it was wild, man. And then we had, from a basketball standpoint, we had Gordon Hayward too. So,
oh my, I missed that. Oh my God.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of wild, man. It's not like Brownsburg, some like powerhouse or like big town, you know, like it was just, I don't know. It was weird, man.
And then for reference, cause we'll talk about him later. You had Tucker Barnhart too. So three big leaguers in one small Indiana town, all playing together at the same time.
Yeah. So that was cool. You know, being able to throw to Tuck in the big leagues. That was like such a cool moment, and always had entertaining mound visits with him.
And with you baseball growing up, growing up with your dad specifically, was there ever any doubt that like baseball would be your thing, career aside, but just like you're the sport that you want to be around, the sport you wanted to play?
Yeah, I was pretty much 50-50 basketball and baseball that going into high school. And then, you know, I always joke that I held Eric Gordon to 35 in a game, and I said I should probably play baseball. It was never like I was not a prodigy. Like it was, I just wanted to, going into my freshman year of high school, I just wanted to be able to walk on at Purdue. Like I thought that'd be cool. My, you know, family went there, like awesome. And then after my freshman year, I think I hit like 87 and, you know, then 90. And so then it became, I might be able to go somewhere to play, you know, kind of, you know, like we say in all the interviews, right? A day at a time. It was always the dream. And I was always just going to do it until, you know, somebody said no.
Let's go backwards just a little bit. You're a high school basketball player and you have to play Eric Gordon that night. Is that an exciting feeling or is that abject terror?
It used to be more fun when he was like, we were both the same height going into high school. So he got an extra, you know, 8 inches or whatever. So that at that point, I was never a defensive star anyway. So it was more of just preservation. It was kind of my name of my game. And, you know, the best defense is a good offense. I think I was one of the first to market on the really long three-pointer. Wasn't always hitting them, but I sure tried.
you're ahead of the game. As you get into high school, you start getting attention from colleges, start getting attention from scouts. How did you go about evaluating the college decision? Because you obviously expanded your horizons quite a bit from the state of Indiana. And then I also have to ask, like, were you busting it in the classroom, or did you know what's the you, when you go to Stanford, you obviously make some assumptions about what someone's doing in the classroom.
I had good grades. I wasn't. I don't know. I'm always like a design guy. So that I always knew I wanted to design cleats or design something. So I wanted to find a program that had industrial design or product design as a major. So luckily good baseball programs tended to have that major. So, but you know, I didn't talk to North Carolina or, you know, Vandy, that was another one that had been good, but like didn't have my major. So, Stanford had it, and I was like, man, if I can get in this place, like, I got to go. And I went, when I went out there, just all the tradition and, like, the guys just aligned, you know? So luckily for me, there were a couple guys from Indiana that went to play at Stanford. So they played for the same travel organization I did. So they kind of paved the way that it wasn't completely out of nowhere. So I'm very thankful for those guys.
With going to Stanford and like you have this idea in your head, you know, this is my major, these are the things I want to do. But obviously you're going to, you know, a top tier baseball program that has been to the Men's College World Series a bunch. And like, I guess like balancing those dreams or balancing like the, you know, I'm at this school, the school is hard. You know, I know one of the things that I'm sure they sell you and all the other recruits on is like the value of a Stanford degree. But once you're on campus and once you're, lack of a better word, like in the shit, in the Pac-10 and stuff, how much are you thinking about, oh, well, I got to get these grades too, and I'm excited to get this degree? Or does that all kind of go away once you're in the baseball of it all?
Well, I would say my sophomore year, because I was a draft eligible sophomore. So once I had it, I went out to the Cape my freshman year and pitched well there. And I'm like, man, I think I might have a pretty good chance of signing this year. And then as that kind of looked better and better, I was like, man, okay, we got to plan a little long-term here. And, you know, kept the courses a little light on the, you know, that last quarter there, but I still had to grind through. Like the worst experience ever was trying to do thermodynamic physics. I just was so frustrated with that class.
As an underclassman too, because that's supposed to, like, normal at other schools, that's kind of like you're taking your basics.
Yeah, so that was the one thing that I was more into, the art side of the product design major, but Stanford was pretty heavy on the engineering part. And so I'm like, I don't have any interest in making rockets, but like I was just trying to get by on that one. But it was cool because I got to do one class where it was like product drawing and, you know, kind of doing specs and all that. And the guy that taught it was an Apple designer. And so he, you know, told me, like, complimented me on like my drawing or whatever it was. Right. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. That's like a legit, I might actually be good at this, because you don't really know. Like, and so that was always a cool thing to have that. So I always knew that would be my backup plan, because I always wanted to be able to play baseball, you know, thinking house money, like not over leverage. Like, I got something to fall back on if something goes wrong.
So your freshman year at Stanford, you guys, it's a College World Series team. Incidentally, is the only College World Series I've been to. So went to watch you guys. Yeah, I watched one of your games. I remember watching. You know, I want to take this time to remember some guys. I had completely forgotten that Toby Gerhart was on that roster.
Yeah,
pitching against that guy, who was he looked like a brick wall.
Oh yeah. Oh, like, the guy was so massive. He was my locker mate too. So you want to talk about just feeling worthless as a human, because he's over there taking 20 credit hours and, like, you know, an engineering degree, and then hitting football lifts and hitting bombs. Like, the guy was incredible, man. Like,
freaking nature.
Oh, so much fun to watch play football too. The coolest thing, our coach, first couple practices I was out there, was like, "Men, you know the Cougar at Toby's high school? They renamed him Toby the Cougar." I'm like, they already renamed his high school mascot after him, and he was a, you know, sophomore or something. I'm like, dude, what a beast.
Yeah, between him, Luck, and McCaffrey, all in like a 10-year run. Quite the run for Stanford football there.
It certainly changed a lot from my freshman year.
Oh, without a doubt. Harbaugh coming in, and
oh yeah.
Jason Castro, you got to pitch to him. Also, I assume in inter-squads, pitch against him. When you've got a first round catcher as a freshman, just what's the level of comfort there, and just being able to trust that guy?
Oh, a ton. I mean, couldn't ask for a better situation, you know, especially that's getting used to coming into games out of the bullpen. And he was great. Always back there fighting. We had some pretty good battles in inter-squads. So yeah, he was fun, man. His swing, man, his junior year, I don't know if I saw a better swing. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, got picked in the first round for a reason. Yeah,
right. We were on a Southwest flight when that happened.
And, you know, oh, yeah, back when the draft was like during all the postseason
we were flying to Fullerton, I think.
They were flying you guys Southwest.
Yeah.
I thought Stanford had it more than that.
Oh yeah, even if we could, it was just kind of the style. It was had to wear a suit. It was very old school.
Listen, I love South. I'm flying Southwest next week. I just, you know, you make assumptions.
That's
once you get onto campus, you obviously I would assume, you know, judging by your high school stats, did not have much trouble with whoever was in the box against you in general, as most guys who get drafted out of high school or big D1 recruits do. You know, if you can top 90, at least, you know, especially back then when 90 was faster. When you get on campus and suddenly you're facing the Jason Castros and the Toby Gerharts, how did it change how you went about accessing your repertoire and kind of changing how you attacked hitters versus high school, where I would imagine it was a lot of fastball, or maybe they get the breaking ball if they're competent.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I was a tiny kid. So when I first started pitching, like I mean, I had a good arm, but it's not like I was throwing straight fuel. So I always pitch backwards. And so that was kind of something, even in high school, I'd throw probably more fastballs, but I really locked into doing that. If hitter, you want a fastball, go to the cage, man, I'm going to spin you. Like, and again, like you said, I was hitting 94, 95, which at that time was something.
That was gas. That was gas back in 08.
But yeah, it was good. Like, I would say the biggest thing I had to learn was like facing like really good left-handed hitters. So Castro obviously being one of them, but you had like Kipnis, Arizona State. Who else? I mean, all those guys that were like, oh, okay, Wallace. Yeah. You know, you had guys.
No, that 08 Arizona State team had, I think, Wallace, Kipnis, and Ike Davis.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were all still there at the same time, but.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. Mm-hmm. So it was, I had to figure out left-handers pretty quickly.
I would assume. Yeah. So talk to me about the importance of adding, like, how many changeups did you throw in high school?
None. Yeah. I didn't really have a good changeup until, I don't know, like 2014.
So like four or five years into your big league career.
And then, yeah, cause I was always trying, I was playing with, you know, we had Jeff Inman out at Stanford who just had a Kleenex changeup. And then obviously with Tyler Clippard too, I saw those guys. So I'm like trying to figure out how to feather this, you know, and once I kind of said, forget it. And just, I'm going to throw a power changeup. Cause I saw Strasburg doing it. I'm like, okay, maybe that's it. And once I figured that out, man, it was a game changer. I wish I would have had that earlier.
I'm sure. You mentioned that Arizona State lineup after like the Pac-12 and that what opposing team or opposing stadium was the one that when you're coming in for a save, especially like a long save, made your heart beat the fastest.
Yeah, Arizona State just from their lineup was always up there. My first road trip, I think we played at Texas, so that was pretty sick. That was kind of the first time that like people Googled you and, you know, they made all their Indiana jokes, you know. I would say that was good. I mean, we didn't – Fullerton was always pretty cool. I mean, I know they weren't in our division, but we always had good battles with them. And, but I think that Arizona State team, man, like they were electric.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was like six or seven big leaguers deep. At least Leak was on that team and hitting. What a lineup.
Yeah.
On that, you slotted into seemingly the closer role, but not like big league one inning kind of sense, or especially in your freshman year, a ton of multi-inning outings, you know, your last college outing was a multi-inning outing, like things like that. Was that the plan when the season started? When they tell you you're going to be, I would say not a closer, but like a finisher.
Yeah. They said, you know, you're going to be our guy, you know, so you're going to be the fireman and all that. So like essentially when it hits the fan, you're going in, I'm like, great. So the first game, I think would have been Fullerton or something. I came in and tying run on base or something like that. And dude, I fell in love with the adrenaline of it. And the idea that like, I could go out there and blow the game and I can fix it tomorrow instead of sitting on it for 5 days and, you know, swim in my own head. So I fell in love with it. So when I sophomore year though, like I was willing to start. If teams wanted me to start, I would be willing to do that. But of course I wanted to stay in the bullpen because I met Chad Cordero when I was 14 and I saw him pitch in Omaha that year and he was in the big leagues by September. So I always had that like, man, if I could be a reliever, move quick through the minor leagues. And so kind of a cool full circle thing.
I was going to say funny how that worked out. Right. But before that, you did mention, I have to ask about just pitching in Omaha as a freshman, taking it all in. Is it something that you can have the appreciation for at the time? Or is it only like in retrospect, that was great?
No, you definitely do. Cause like, to me, that's Omaha's the closest thing to the big leagues. And that's where, I think from a development side, you can't replace that experience. Especially like semi-state, like I'm in high school, super regionals there, against Fullerton, right? Like I came in that game, tying run was on second and like, you know, it's on TV. All my buddies are like texting like, oh man, it's, I'm like, dude, if I give up a bomb here, you know, like it's the first time you're really like trying to overthink something like that. And then I was like, who cares? You know, like I had to learn that. And once I did that, it really, I mean, helped because that's, you can't stimulate that situation, especially I think my first appearance in Omaha was I faced Posey. I come up against, you know, Nintendo Buster Posey at the time, right? Like just crazy legend. But yeah, man, that was so much fun.
Yeah, I would. I always shout it out, but there's a book. Ryan McGee from ESPN wrote a book about that Omaha, the Road to Omaha, which is just one of my favorites. It's something I love rereading, and just what a loaded class that was of just draft picks that year between Castro and Beckham and Alonzo and Grandal at Miami, and obviously Posey, and just an insane, insane College World Series.
That is a great book.
Yeah. Oh, love it. I mean, just for any baseball fan, it is just the best. The best. It would make such a good baseball movie. It makes me sick that it's not a real thing.
It is so good. The way that he describes Marquess is amazing, because unique coach. I love playing for him, but man, there's some really interesting things that he did.
I wanted to ask, what is the secret? Like, how did, I mean, he was obviously a legend. Stanford remained relevant and a power for so long at a very, not what you would imagine, like a typical school to do that, because of how hard it is to get guys in. Like we've seen with football, Stanford football can flame out tremendously just because there are basically 100 guys who can play for them at any year, and they can also play for other schools. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, basketball programs, the same thing. I just think I really think they did a great job in finding what their in-state guys are like. So the guys with grades and like having the Indiana pipelines or whatever it is, like, you know, Marquess told me he loves recruiting from the north, which I thought was brilliant, because it's like, once you get to play year round, everybody gets way better, you know? I think there's just been so much, there's strong tradition there, and like, it is a unique experience playing out there. And there's just an expectation, like, you're going to work crazy hard and it's all about winning. Like, nothing else matters. It is live and die every day with a win or a loss.
And I mean, you guys did a lot of winning. So 09 draft eligible sophomore, sounded like, I was going to ask, you know, any part of you want to stay, because you would have retained leverage despite being a little bit older, but it sounded like you were one foot, you were ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, going into my sophomore year, I was talking to Jeff Austin, our pitching coach, and you know, he's like, I don't want you to worry about the draft. I want to prepare you to pitch in the big leagues by September. And so like, that was a cool, you know, adjustment mentally to go, okay, I need to hold myself to that standard, and this is what I have, you know. So that was my main goal. I didn't get it, but obviously I had a quick turn the next year. So for me, that's locking it in of like, it's never good enough, right? Mm-hmm. That like, okay, yeah, we can go get three outs or whatever, but how did I do it? Like, did I just do it because I faced college guys, or, you know, like, just having that, I was a very fanatical guy on my routine, like the cord, you name it, right? Like, that was before people were really doing all that stuff. But, you know, I really locked in my routine, try to do the same thing every day. Just to prepare myself, you know, and luckily it worked out.
I want to key on the thing you said about, did I get those three outs just because those were college guys? So as you're trying to prepare, if you're pitching at Stanford, but you're trying to prepare for being in the big leagues that September, what were like the checkpoints you were trying to hit of how you were getting guys out, or the things you could do, the things that you guys were working on that said, this is how you get hitters out in the big leagues?
Yeah, it was, a lot of it was, you know, maintaining my arm. So as you mentioned, I had some long outings.
Yes.
So that was, and making sure that I wasn't coming in the next day or whatever and throwing 88. So I would say from a physical standpoint, that was a big, big adjustment. You know, I wanted to overpower, just embarrass guys. Like, there wasn't any like markers. I just wanted to make guys look bad. And if I was dominating these guys, then just keep that same approach. I was a very offensive pitcher. Like, I was a big K-Rod fan. So like, I liked the attack, and kind of kept that mentality. And you know, I'm thrilled that I made it through there, because like I said, those are some, looking back, man, those are some crazy long outings I threw.
Yeah, I mean, and again, the difference in college is like, it's about the win, versus, you know, if you'd signed out of high school, your outings probably look a lot different in the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. as in the run up to the draft, you're kind of like you were talking, you are that every year. It seems like every year there's a, hey, there's the college reliever who could be in the big leagues in September. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. what eventually became like the Brandon Finnegan, like the perfect, yes. the perfect model yeah. for that. But with that, so there's a lot of different things that then factor into those negotiations of obviously talking to teams and like who's willing to move you that fast. And then also the money factor, and you end up signing with the Nats, who have to sign that pick because they had forfeited it the year before. So you become mm-hmm. the underslot. They're obviously, you know, that we're going to have to pay out the wazoo for the guy they took 1-1. Mm-hmm. I assume that was prearranged, because I can't imagine they took you without knowing the number. But like, how many different places did you think you could fall, or did you feel pretty good about Nats at 10, 1-6?
There were probably four different teams, including the Nats, that like I knew, I think if I got to like through 15 or something, that we would need to try to slide down, I think, to the Yankees, or, you know, there was all these different scenarios. But I knew, as long as Mike Minor was off the board when the Nats picked, then I was good. So I knew within that, Wheeler needed to go. And then Minor went, he went to the Braves.
So right? I think he went 7 to the Braves. And I also think he went under slot. Like, he was like the safer college son.
And so, yeah, that, and for me, I'm like, okay, this $200,000 that, like, realistically, like, if I get up to the big leagues and I am a super two, I make way more than that. So, like, don't let that, like, this perfect situation, you know, my goal was to beat Strauss to the big league. So that was, I mean, he ended up winning in the long term, but, you know,
he made out okay financially, might say.
Yeah. Dude, I mean, but watching him, man, I'd never seen anything like it.
I had you were the 10th overall pick, and no one's talking about you comparatively to, is there kind of like a relief in that?
Oh, yeah. I was. He was that next level, man. Nobody had buzz like that back in the day, and be able to see that up close. And I was really anticipating not being that impressed by him. Like, I'm like, okay, I'm sure. And then the first time I saw him warm up down in Arizona for fall league game, I'm like, oh man, dude, I don't deserve to be in the same league as this guy.
I remember just watching, like, there was a video specifically of when he was at San Diego State and just warming up in the bullpen. And it's like a, you know, it's 2009, like the video quality mm-hmm. isn't crazy, but I just remember it just looks like he's throwing bullets.
His breaking ball is the thing that was the next level, right? Like, he had like that heavy ride, but man, that power slurve, or, you know, whatever you call it, never seen anything like it. It's like him and Rick Ankiel, I saw, you know, Rick would spin some breaking balls. Those are the two that I'm like, man, that next level.
I want to stick on that for a second, because obviously he was an outfielder when you were playing with him. But so he would still, like, when you're warming up in the outfield or doing something, he would just be like, hey, I still have this in the bag.
Oh yeah. Like during BP, just you hear like, come on, Rick. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing, because like, some of the, like, I remember one of the guys missed it one time. It's like, dude, we're catching breaking balls every day. And like, you got beat by that. Like, okay. Like, yeah, he was awesome, man.
It's funny. There was a clip on like Instagram or something, but it was him. I think I think it was like Willie Tavares was tagging up, and he threw just a seed at just a strike from center field. And it was just one of the, like, man, the mind is a crazy thing.
Oh man. And that was probably one of the coolest plays I was involved in. It's like, whenever they show his highlight tape, I'm on this one, because it was a guy trying to get a triple at Great American Ballpark. So, you know, in the gap there, and Rick goes like one hop from all the way across the field, just perfect. And like, to see that like straight on was so cool. Like, man,
beautiful. Just a absolute cannon. So you sign at 10. I have to, this isn't the most like well thought out question. Did you buy anything dumb?
I wanted to buy a GTR. But then I want, cause a concept car came out like my senior year. So I was like, okay. So then I changed it to, if I make it to the big leagues, then I'll buy it. And that's what I did. So when I made it,
smarter decision.
Yeah. You know, plus optically, you know, you don't, you don't need to be driving a GTR in the minor leagues. That's where I was like, you know, I should probably have some feel.
Some of those towns, you don't really want to pull in a lot of places.
No.
Certain minor league towns are
sketchier
than others.
So I ended up getting it after my rookie year, and I still have it. So that's always been my like big league gift to myself.
I love that. So let's talk about then the workload change, because the professional reliever is much different than the college reliever, especially how you were being used in college. And in college, you know, you have the week break, essentially, or at least you have the 5-day break. I would assume you didn't throw many minute week games. How quickly did your body get in tune to one inning outings for the most part, but a little closer space together?
Yeah. So that for me, playing up in the Cape is what prepared me for it. Cause as you mentioned, like I could throw those long appearances because I had 2 to 3 days off on the Cape, man. It was all right. Sprint, pull the chute, pack the chute, sprint again, keep going, rinse and repeat. So, that was cool. Cause luckily the Arizona State guys were on Contuit with me, and they had just gotten into the crossover symmetry bands. And so they taught me that program, and I just started hammering that with them. And then I read the John Feinstein book, Living on the Black. And then, and I talked about there, I think Glavin, but just essentially throwing through shoulder soreness. And like, once I started doing that, my velo started going up. So played a lot of long toss. People always thought I threw too much, but I don't know.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
Your career in just like the last 10, 15 years are this really interesting part of baseball development. How often would you say, like throughout your career, and obviously as you got older and like health started to be a thing, I'm sure that affected how you were able to train and things you were able to do. How often did your, like say the routine you had when you got to the minor leagues, how often did what you were doing change in a big fundamental way? Or did you kind of, you know, I got here with this, I'm going to stick with this throughout my career?
That's the balance, right? And, you know, you want to be coachable, but at the same time, you got to die on your hill, right? Like you got to throw your pitch. So I had my routine, but what I would do, especially since I was going to big league camps and I'm just watching the veteran dudes, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try that. I'll add that in. If I liked it, I kept it, you know, and all that. So there was always like little pieces I was trying to steal from somebody else. Cause my theory was, there's no reason that I need to figure it out on my own when I can just watch what they do. So that was kind of the cords always stayed, which, you know, I got my first spring training, I got some flack from a veteran in the bullpen. Like, what are you doing? Like, I'm warming up. Like, you know, now look at it.
Now it's like the most, like you have, it's almost you like have you have to. Right?
Yeah. But yeah, man, it was something that, you know, once I started playing with Clippard, he was a big contrast bath guy. So we would do that, which I would have never done that on my own, but you know, that's why he was able to pitch for so long, man. He did that habitually.
Walk me through that. What is that?
The contrast. So you know, it'd be 105 degrees and then, you know, your 40 degree tub and just, oh yeah. Oh,
I'm too soft for it. In college, yeah. I would dip my arm in the tub sometimes, but I'm too soft for the whole body.
Yeah, yeah. I was always about the tingle. You got the payoff of when, you know, but man, that 2 minutes in the ice is not it.
Big yikes. Big yikes. So your professional debut, you sign, get to double A, lights out in the fall league. By, you know, spring training 2010, early season 2010, are you just like counting the days? Like it's coming?
I was hopeful. You know, I was disappointed that I didn't make the team out of spring, which I mean, I understand, but I was kind of, that put a little chip on my shoulder to, you know, make sure and prove it. So when I went to AAA though, I had a couple rough ones, like, cause those guys are, that was the first time you're facing real hitters. Right. And, but I figured it out, you know, you had to figure it out quick. And, you know, when I got the call, it was pretty amazing, man. Tough to
walk
put
me
in.
Through it. Walk yeah, me through the call.
So it was funny because it was a big swing because we were in Portland and they put me in a game in like the fifth inning. And I was not thrilled about that because I was like ambushed by it. So I go in and get like two outs and they're like, all right, you're done. I'm like, what is going on? I've been closing and then they're like, all right, yeah, Skip wants to talk to you. And, you know, so went back there. He's like, well, the reason is because you're going up. I'm like, oh, then great. Thanks for getting me out. You know, complete change. So man, yeah, that was just like, huh. You still get the emotions. It's like between that and like when Bud Selig said my name getting drafted, just like those moments that, you know, my life's not going to be the same, which it was pretty special.
Then what's the sitting in the bullpen? Cause like if a starter comes up, you know, hey, you're on the mound, your debut is coming this, you can kind of keep your routine, whatever. You've been closing in the minor league. Suddenly you're sitting in the bullpen and you're staring at the phone.
Oh yeah. Oh man. And just bouncing around. And then when they called, pretty sure my first like two or three throws were just peppering the wall. I just airmailed it. Cause I was like, at the time I just would go max effort out of the gate and just reel it in from there. And I mean, my heart rate was 500, man. It was wild.
Do you remember do you remember the outing? And I've had guys who remember it in detail, hitters, pitches, whatever. And then others are just like, I think I faced this guy. I think I got him to pop out, whatever. Kind of, how does that one come back?
Yeah. I'm like wishy-washy on it. I think it was Pedro Feliz was the first guy I faced and he popped out and then I smoked. I can't remember his name. Oh, Ryan Lugwood.
Big guy.
Yeah. Huge guy. Smoked him right in the wrist. Rightfully upset about that. And then Matt Holliday was up. So I had him in a full count. And if I would have walked him, I would have had Pujols. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so luckily did not got the strikeout and got out of it.
You mentioned that, you know, the outing right before your call was, you know, they throw you in the fifth inning. You're like, oh, I've been closing, whatever. You come up, you're not the closer. And what kind of we'll kind of talk about with your big league career, is there periods where you're the closer, you're the guy, there's that set routine, and then periods when you're not. And there is often that thing of, you know, non-save situations just don't have the juice. There's that classic thing of like closers typically pitch bad in non-save situations, whether it's statistically backed up or whatever. When you're up, it's probably different when you're up for the first time, you're just trying to stick in the big leagues, but just in general, the mental difference of getting in the game when it is a save situation, you are the closer, you're who the Nats or whoever is turning to, versus it's the seventh. And it's maybe it's a tight situation, maybe it's not, but you've got to work.
And that's, you know, for me, I always talk about it is almost easier at times to close because, you know, it's on the hitter to be the hero. So as long as you don't make an egregious mistake, you're going to be okay. Right. That's why I was pitching backwards as much as I was, because they're trying to be the hero. And when you're in a setup situation or even like a one run deficit, like you don't always know what that guy's approach is at the plate. So that makes it a little bit more difficult. And then also you're throwing a lot more. So you're going to get up for games and not go in there, where if you're closing, like we're lucky to have a great bullpen that when the phone rang in the sixth, you knew who it was, seventh, eighth, ninth, you know, all the way through. And that's when the grind doesn't happen as much when it's kind of more of an autopilot. But yeah, when things start getting shuffled around, it gets a little wild, tougher to stick with the routine then.
What is when in those times when you are the guy for the Nats, because there were a few seasons where, you know, you were the closer the whole time. What is, you know, 162 is that's a lot. That's a lot of days, a lot of games, whatever. And, you know, you're preparing for one specific inning that may or may not happen. What did the game day routine, if you're getting to the ballpark in the early afternoon and you might not pitch until 10:30?
Try to do everything from the second I showed up was hopefully helping me get three outs. So whatever I thought, you know, I would always hot tub, kind of do like a warm up workout kind of deal. And then early in my career, it was like max effort, long toss, like every day, flat ground. And then would do the contrast bath, like either the first couple innings. So Clip and I had our own routine down there and, you know, would always rub the red hot, but we used cheese, which was next level. Sometimes that would come back to bite you some days where it was just a little too hot, but yeah, man, it was pretty set. And that's what I wanted it to be that way. Cause then I would never be nervous if I prepared the right way. Right. Like if I half-assed my routine, then yeah, you're probably gonna be a little nervous. Like, man, hopefully this isn't, you know, what derails the whole thing.
When you're young, you're with the Nats, like that 2011, 2012, the franchise was young. I mean, you know, they were the Expos, but really there's no history. They had never been to the playoffs. They had been historically bad, which is why they ended up with Strasburg and Harper in back-to-back years. And there's this momentum of, you know, this big story of, you know, young team, you know, whatever, trying to make it to the playoffs for the first time for this city and this franchise and whatever. When you're actually in it, and you know, you're this team. I assume if you're like playing for the Yankees, the Red Sox, there's something about the historical of it all of who you're playing for and having the rivalry at the Yankees. Everyone knows about that. But like, if it had been the same group of guys, but you were playing for the Brewers, is the mentality you take different, or is there anything you take from like, hey, let's be the first team to make it to the playoffs for the Nationals? Like, does it really matter? It's not the same as college.
Yeah. I think there was definitely a big difference between obviously 10 and 11 and then 12. It just, you added in DeRosa, you know, J-Dub came over, Worth came over the year before, but like some of the things that he really implemented with the team started paying off. Right. So essentially it was more fun to win and not lose 100 games. And like, you know, people were showing up, you know, like once Strasburg's debut happened, like you saw the potential of that fan base. And so that was kind of cool to see from, you know, not being relevant to being the show in town. So it was pretty neat, man.
Yeah. And you mentioned like Worth and DeRosa coming. What there's the cliche, you know, veteran presence. What does that really bring? What do guys like that bring? Like what do they instill? Is it things guys are required to do? Is it level of attention paid? Kind of what is veteran presence?
Honestly, from a like treatment standpoint, like we got a full-time massage therapist and like our food got better. And that's, you know, that was a lot of Worth talking to the ownership and saying, ironically, since he owns racehorses now, but that we're racehorses and like we were not getting the best food ever before he came. And so just an extra level there at D-Row, like he was the guy that just kind of kept everybody off the emotional roller coaster of the season, right? Like, you do have young guys that are trying to make a name for themselves. And it's easy to get twisted up a little bit, but D-Row kept it loose, you know, like the ability to just laugh at things when it hits the fan, like that's it. That's what you got to do. And, you know, it timed out well with all the young talent we had. And it was a pretty fun year.
Yeah. I mean, everything coming together, just as a fan was very cool. The Strasburg debut, eventually the Harper debut and everything that came with that. Yeah. But 2012, you had surgery before the season, removing bone spurs. Like, how did you spend your time without baseball? I'm being sure it was an intensive rehab process and all that stuff, but like probably I would assume the longest you'd gone without playing baseball in ever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was tough, man. Cause you know, rolling off of 2011, having a great year and then wanting to build off of that. And then that was like my first outing in spring training and just, oh man, something's wrong. So kind of some lonely times down there in Florida, kind of grinding while watching the team dominate. Right. And I'm just trying to speed it up, trying to get back. And yeah, man, it wasn't easy, but you know, we had, I had a good group of guys down there. Mike Gonzalez was down there. So it was cool. Like kind of hanging out with him and like
the lefty, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and then Brad Lidge was down there too. So like,
no legend.
Yeah. He's the best.
Phil Slider, man.
Oh yeah. So, but yeah, man, it was tough, but, you always know it's only a matter of time before something happens. So
that it started the trend though, when you get back, like Clippard's having a great year, he's closing. Then you guys are like splitting roles. You eventually take over, but it's kind of almost for the rest of your tenure with the Nats, that seemed like some, you know, Rafael Soriano will come in, Papelbon comes in.
Yep.
You know, there's being a team player. And then there's also got to be part of you that's like, this sucks. I just give me the, you know, just give me the job.
Right. There was, yeah, it was tough, man. And like hindsight, the game was so different then too, man. Like you weren't getting paid for holds, you know, like you're getting paid for saves. So that's why everybody wanted it, you know? And yeah, it was difficult. Cause especially like once I dug myself out from like either a bad year or bad playoff game or whatever it was, then something else would happen. Then it'd be like a step back and like, it's tough, man. It was really difficult to get through it, but you know, it's one of those things, man, it's a business. And I've never claimed to be a good baseball player when it comes to the business side of it. Like I played it for the college guy in me. It turned it into a business pretty quickly, which wasn't as fun.
Do you think your career would have been mentally easier if how we looked at relievers was more like now, where saves aren't necessarily thought of as end all be all, but it's like, hey, this guy's been, you know, kind of the fireman. The fireman has kind of come back in a way.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like if the landscape like it is now, you know, was then, I think it would have just been a different angle. But then you needed to be the closer, to be the guy, you know? I loved doing it. And that's kind of the blessing and the curse. Cause when you come up and within your first year, you get some saves and you're the closer and half 2011 happened, then you're like, oh, okay, I got this. And then that's the name of the game though, right? At some point something's going to happen. And it's, I always tell people, it's like you're Maverick, you're going to kill Goose at some point. So you got to figure it out,
man. That one cuts deep. You know, with that, with whether you're the closer or whether you're just a guy in the bullpen, like stuff, it comes down to you. It is, you know, people remember who blew the save, who locked down the save, whatever. One of the best things I've read in a long time was this morning. I read a story that your dad wrote for Sports Illustrated. Are you familiar with what I'm about watching you dealing with the nerves, like? Excellent structure, like intertwining between like your youth and coming back to this game you're pitching against the Dodgers. I get nervous watching my kid play in Little League. Can't imagine what your parents are going through. But I bring that up because, like I said, you know, the emotions of a game ends with you one way or another, typically throughout most of your career. And it's a lot of the time, most of the time, it's 10:30 at night. Your emotions are, you know, either real high or down in the dumps. And like, what would you do and who would you turn to wind down the good or the bad after the game?
So that I was lucky to be living with Clippard at that point. So, I've always said I would probably not have the career I did without him. Him and I are about polar opposites in the way we go about things. He's extremely laid back and just,
that's probably why he's a good golfer too. He's like for being a great golfer.
Oh yeah. But just incredibly mentally strong, like just doesn't let things get to him. And like, I'm high strung, you know, which, you know, hey, I cook with gas, baby. Like, it's, but it
might be genetic. Cause in that article your dad is talking about, he has to like pace when he watches you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's it. But, yeah, man, it was Clip was extremely helpful. And obviously like Brad Lidge and like dudes like that, just kind of talking through it and like, all right, you know, how do you handle this? Like, especially for me, man, like, I always talk to Clip about it. Well, my failure was at the big league level. Like a lot of times guys have that in the minor leagues, like have to really figure it out. And so that was different developmentally. It's like, all right, I got to figure myself out under the microscope, you know? So that was, it was good to have people around for that, because it was not the easiest thing in history.
Yeah, I'm sure. And in your, there's up and downs early in your career. There are points when you've been lights out. You had, you know, some obviously like some tough playoff outings and things like that. You have a tougher 2013. It's not a disaster or anything, but it's just like fine. And then 2014, you're just lights out the whole year. Just shave 3 runs off your ERA, fewer walks, fewer hits. Just everything is better. What's the secret?
That's a good question. I don't know. The changeup, actually, but my changeup really started helping me out then. And we, you know, again, it was a routine. So, you know, Clip had the 7th, I had the 8th, Sori had the 9th. Like that was our routine. So like, it was nice for rinse and repeat. So I always think that was a part of it. But it was really just getting my mechanics down. Like 2013, you know, I was still doing a slide step and I didn't really like it. And I wanted to go back to my leg kick.
It was kind of like you had it was like a gradual thing. You had like a distinctive slide step.
Yeah. And it was just kind of one of those things. I ran into that and I'm like, oh, this is good. But then I always like changing things, right? And optically, they don't always like it when you change things. And so I'm like, well, if it's not working, then I want to change. Like that's, I want to mess with things. And so that's when I brought back my leg kick and, you know, had my little pause that, you know, as I learned, annoyed hitters a lot. And so it was fun, man. That's, to me, it was kind of the dying on your hill. Like, look, if I'm going to do this, like I have to be 100% confident in myself, not going, trying to be a people pleaser about it. But yeah, I remember my last outing in 2014, just being so tight, going, man, don't give up a bomb here. Don't give up. don't blow it. Don't blow it.
And I mean, you cement, you have that great year. 2015 starts out great. Not as, you know, doesn't finish as strong. When did you know, we talk about the business of baseball. When did you know that your time in DC might be coming to an end?
Yeah, I kind of knew it after that year. Like, yeah, so that was, you know, the learning experience in itself when you go to a different organization and kind of really, I fell into that coach, you know, trying to be coachable and got away from what made me a little bit. And, cause I got real sinker happy and I'm like, my sinker was okay, but like, it wasn't something that I could throw pitch after pitch and guys wouldn't crush it. So, that
would also lead presumably like more contact, more balls on the ground, and you went to go play on turf.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, again, it's just one of those things, man, where you just, no matter what, you keep going out there and trying something new and just didn't work. So once I got to Seattle, man, I grew up a huge Mariners fan. I'm sure like everybody else, but like, yeah,
that one specific reason to, yeah. 2-4.
Yep. And so going out there was like, oh man, all right, breath of fresh air, you know, and they put me in those spots, man, to go dig people out. And like, I love that. But yeah, it was just kind of adjustments, man. That's all it is. And the second you think you got it figured out, something else, you know, pops up or whatever, you know, just a nonstop swimming against the current, I think sometimes.
You sign with the Reds, and then we come all the way back to you're playing with Tucker Barnhart, who you grew up with. It had to just be completely surreal.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the only, like, the second time that's ever happened, that high school battery. And then, but yeah, it was great, man. Like, he's always been, like, I would say he's like my little brother. And so to be able to play with him every day. And, you know, when I threw the immaculate inning, that was like, so cool. Like, cause
doing my job for me. Cause I was going to ask about,
yeah,
like,
I mean, that was it. Like, that was it, man. Cause Tuck and I were probably the only ones watching the game at that point, but it was awesome. I'm like, cause
you,
I got
you talk about perfect games. Like, when, you know, when did you know you're throwing a perfect game? Immaculate inning is obviously 9 pitches. How, you know, is it 4 pitches in, 5 pitches in? Are you like, we're doing something here?
Once I had 2 punchies, I'm like, oh, okay. You know, don't mess this up. And then I threw a first pitch breaking ball, and I knew if I executed on that, I'd be fine. And yeah, it was awesome. I always take pride in that because I used the same ball the whole time. So there was no foul tips. It was same ball, boom, 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 boom.
how often, like, how that's the thing about like watching big league games, just different ball all the time. Just how, what's like your app, you know, what would you say the average is, like a couple pitches or something like that?
Or it's like probably two or three pitches, maybe.
Would you say the quality control is there? Like, or is it, does it always feel the same, or sometimes you get a ball back and you're like, who rubbed this up?
Since her hand's sewn, that's when, you know, guys are throwing them out. Cause there is a definite difference. Like, especially like if one had like a flat seam, I didn't want that if I was going to be pulling a sinker or slider or whatever. So you wanted to have one that was, you know, a little bit better. Some of them felt harder than others sometimes, you know, but those golf balls kind of flew pretty well for a couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when you said quality control, I'm like, yeah, that's, they made sure those babies were full of it.
The year where everyone could hit 40 home runs. The end of your career is interesting for two way, kind of the tail end. You've been in the big leagues for 6-7 years, and then you have Tommy John's, but it's, you know, it's as you're like a free agent and things like that. And then also as you're rehabbing, you've got to find a job. You got to kind of figure out the next step. Your agent becomes the general manager of the Mets.
Yeah. That was interesting.
How important, I guess, I'm sure it's different for all guys. I know not everyone is Jerry Maguire and Rod Tidwell, but like how important is the agent relationship for you over the course of your career? And then I would assume that had to be from the second he signed that contract with the Mets, like a no contact thing. I'm sure that's some sort of conflict of interest.
So it wasn't ideal, but like, for me, if I would have just pitched better, it doesn't matter who your agent is, you know. But it was good. You know, I talked to Brody. It was after, it's like during COVID, essentially, like when they sent us home from camp. And because before that year, he wouldn't sign me, obviously. So I'm like, well, what's the issue? And that's when he's like, well, you know, numbers guys want you up like what you were in your, you know, in 2011. I'm like, man, I don't know that I have that velo anymore. So that's kind of when I saw the writing on the wall a little bit. And I'm like, man, I got this whiskey idea. So I kind of like that. That seems like a little more fun at this point. But yeah, it was a realization of like, okay, the game's changing, which is the way when I was a young guy, that's the way I would want it to be. Right. So like now that I was the veteran dude who would usually just get those jobs, you know, for the presidents or whatever, it changed. So like, how can I be bitter about that when I was the guy that was doing this before, you know, the game got young? So kind of hang with them like part of the game and move on.
So you hang it up, and then how long does, what's the time frame from, I think we should do this whiskey thing to this whiskey is now a thing?
Yeah, I pretty much right away. I was kind of messing around with it, like through COVID and all that. And so I was like, man, okay, talk to a couple lawyers. And then once I called Clipper and I was like, hey man, I'm done. Like, I don't want to play anymore. And he's like, all right, well, if we can do it, then, you know, I'll invest in it. So it's like, you don't have to eat all the risk. And I'm like, so the second he kind of like gave me that pat on the butt, I was like, dude, like, hell yeah. Like, we got to try this. And so that was, I remember it was around Christmas that I was like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I filed trademarks like after that, like, so it was pretty quick, man.
What is, I told you before I started recording, I wrote a book, and I think the most satisfying part of that whole process was just like getting my author copy. What was like holding the first spot? What was the process? Did it get mailed to you? Did you go to, was it at a distillery? Like, what, when did you hold the first bottle?
We went up there for the bottling and everything, man. That's when it was like, wow, this is cool. Like, extremely surreal. Like, we actually did this. So yeah, I remember like the second that they started going, man, we were just like, cause that was like 2 years essentially of like tedious emails, you know, every little thing that we've looked at labels inside and out, and then to have it go and like, man, it's, yeah, it was pretty rewarding. And then when we started selling it and it sold like crazy, I was like, this is completely surreal. Like when I went, we had a bottle signing in my hometown and there's like 150 people in line waiting. And I'm like, what? it was crazy, man. So that's one of those things where like you can't really bake in wins and losses like, you know, old baseball days, but every once in a while you get one of those days where you're like, man, this is pretty amazing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, as a baseball fan, as a sports movie fan, it is the perfect branding. So
we kept waiting for somebody to say no, like, you know, or there'd be kind of just keep going.
Where can, if folks want to check out Field of Dreams or buy it, where can they acquire it?
So we are in 9 states traditionally, but if you just go to our website, you can order it off there, drinkfieldofdreams.com, and we ship, I think, ship to 35 or 40 states right now. So, so we have our small batch on there. Our player series will come out opening day. So that's the one where we do one bottle for every player in Major League history. Our small batch is one of my favorite things that we've done. I don't know if you've seen what we did with the tops, but we hide the players under the cap. So it's kind of like a pack of tops that gets you drunk.
That is perfect. That is awesome. So I would encourage everyone to go check that out. Any fan of baseball and drinking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. we're trying to do, you know, Hall of Famers, but also like Hall of Fame stories. So, you know, got Pat Venditti on there with a right and
alumni of this podcast, Pat Venditti.
Oh, I love it. One of the coolest things I think I have for my career is one of his gloves.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I love that thing.
One of my favorite guests. Just,
yeah, he's great. Cool,
unique story, unique guy. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, and then we've got like Doc Ellis on there. You know,
another unique. What's in that bottle?
Yeah, that's right. The Buhner one might be my favorite art-wise because we did the huge M frames on there.
Legend. Ball. Ran into him at a golf course here where I live, just randomly. It was insane. Tying it all back to baseball, if you could go back and give yourself a pep talk on signing day at like 21, what does that pep talk look like?
Don't sweat the small stuff. Just always play long. I mean, that's one thing. I think the reason why I was able to move quickly and get up there was because I always played the long game, whether that was, you know, turning down money out of high school or, you know, whatever it was. The regrets I have are just when I played it short and you worry like, oh, I got to fix this right now or whatever it is, right? Instead of just go get 3 outs and don't worry about anything else.
Quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here. Favorite Pac-10 opposing ballpark?
I kind of like UW.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was kind of fun. Like, I don't know. Like, weather was kind of weird sometimes, but it was cool. I like the
favorite minor league ballpark. You weren't there that long, so it's kind of hard.
Yeah, probably the Indianapolis Indians. Even though I never actually played there, but I've gone to many games.
Good setup. Favorite big league ballpark?
PNC Park.
Yeah, beautiful. On the bucket list. Best hitter you ever faced?
I mean, Pablo Sandoval owned me for some reason. I always had random guys. Like
not
that.
Just you.
Oh, just you know, just in general. Okay.
Well, no, I was just saying he didn't own just you. So don't feel bad about that.
Yeah, I he hit everything off me. It was crazy.
There was a period of time where he hit everything off. I mean, he was so much fun.
Utley was up there, like just when it comes to like situational hitting and all that. Like any of those guys that like aren't trying to be the hero again, like I mentioned before. Those are the guys that anybody that would want a 6-hole single, like, man, and Utley was so good at getting guys tipping. So I always just would make stuff up when I would face him because I'm like, dude, he probably has me. So
it was just, the swing was so short. It was just so like pure and just, simple. Preferred whiskey cocktail?
Old fashioned.
I assumed it was going to be an old fashioned. So like, what is your method? I know there's a couple different ways.
You know, I don't really have one. I got luckily, our ops guy is he's a cocktail guy. So I have him do it, but I don't have any good tricks, man. The only thing that I'll do is I will smoke the water.
Oh, I like that.
And then freeze it.
I like, that's a nice little touch.
So that's a good one.
I'm going to think about that. Last one. Everyone gets this. Not sure you were there long enough to have one of these, but do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Not really.
there's benefit to getting up quickly.
I guess the minor league story I always tell is like when we were, it was A-ball, where I always say A-ball has, it's always an inverse relationship. So if the stadium's nice, the hotel is awful. The hotel's nice, stadium's awful. So we were in Greensboro and, pulled up to our Ramada at like 1 a.m. and a gentleman pulled up in a truck and offered us some female services. In
the timing.
Yeah. He goes, she's back in the Ramada. And I'm like looking at her key going, oh man, this place is not good. it was so gross. I didn't even shower there. I showered only at the ballpark there at the time.
That's a by the hour establishment.
Yeah. So that's the one that sticks out the most.
Drew, that is all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining for Phenom.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. It was awesome.
Course.
And that's it for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm. Big thanks to Drew Storen for stopping by, walking us through his playing journey and his post-career journey. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We'll be back in a month. Thanks for listening.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Check engine light on. Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
O'Reilly.